Welcome to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. This is the Monday Brown Bagger. We have a pre-recorded interview with Bob Chapman, going to be starting in a couple of minutes. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. This is the 18th of August, 2008. Before we begin our pre-recorded interview with Bob Chapman, we're going to have Dan Thompson, who's going to sing our theme song. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, good day, everybody. Welcome to old rainy old Vancouver day. This is a new song that I wrote about war, written about war. And the thing is, what I want to say before I start this, I wrote this on the idea that I heard that the first casualty of war is always the truth. And the thing is that what I want to say is not. The truth is not the casualty. It's actually when it's first born, the truth comes out in war. That's when you find out who these people really are, how far and how much in depth they can go with their infamy. And the true first casualty of war are women and children and societies. So I wrote this song for them. Sail away, little children, sail with me to a place where we can all be free. And no bombs are falling from the sky, and nobody wants somebody else to die. Oh, I fear so much for your fate, and I can see that the hour's getting late. With so much fear, war, and terror throughout the land, that I've trembled for the future they have planned. Yes, sail away, little children, sail with me, where no one has to die for liberty. And our lives mean so much more than the money. Sail away, little children, sail with me. Yes, if I could only hold you in my arms and keep you safe and free from all the harms that for you those bastards have in store, the ones that send the little babies off to war. Yes, sail away, little children, sail with me, where nobody has to die for liberty. And no bombs are falling from the sky, and nobody wants somebody else to die. Yeah, if I could only hold you in my arms and keep you safe from all the harms that for you those bastards have in store, ones that send the little babies off the wall. We could build a ship of hope, a ship of love, that rides a dream that tries to save above the indifference of those that throw away our tomorrows for the luxury of today. Yes, hail away, little children, time to go to the land where the hope a tree can grow. And no more can a person speculate how much money's to be made out of hate. Yes, sail away, children, sail with me to a place where we can all be free. And no bombs are falling from the sky, and nobody wants somebody else to die. Yes, sail away, little children, sail with me, where nobody has to die for liberty. And our lives mean so much more than the money. Sail away, little children, sail with me.
Welcome to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. This is Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. We have as a guest today Bob Chapman. Bob has spent 3 years in the U.S. Army counterintelligence, mostly in Europe. In 1960, Bob became a stockbroker and retired in 1988. For 18 of those years, he owned his own brokerage firm. And starting in June 1991, Bob began writing the International Forecaster. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. The first question I have to ask you is, with the banking fiasco currently going on in the U.S., and with the collapse of the Indy Bank and a few other major U.S. banks only currently having 30 cents on the dollar in reserve, how is the banking quagmire going to be directly affecting ordinary Canadians and Americans at this time and in the near future?
Well, first of all, anything that happens in America because of the enormous extent of its economy affects everybody in the whole world. And in the subprime problems with those loans and the ALTA loans, many of them were bought by Canadians, Europeans, the Japanese and Chinese governments, and so they get spread out pretty far. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that none of these other professionals in many countries haven't brought civil lawsuits against the packages of these securities, which were collateralized debt obligations, which are bonds, which are consist of mortgages and different types of and different sections of mortgages. It can get quite complex. But the point here is that the current crisis in credit, it's been going on 2 weeks short of a year that we know about, and it's worse now than it was before. And I keep on seeing people in the financial community, particularly on Wall Street, saying that it's 25% over and it's 50% over. And today I read an article by one of the top economists at Morgan Stanley that said it's 65% over. Well, I get news for all of them. It's not that over. It's just really beginning. And the manifestations are enormous because what's happening is that banks don't have the assets on their balance sheets to offset their losses. They and other financial institutions have been raising money outside for equity to be put into their firms so the books will balance, to make it simple. And they still have plenty of things to write off which are on their balance sheets, and some of it which is not on their balance sheets. And how that happens, your guess is as good as mine. And so we have this ongoing problem, and at the same time, banks are being able to borrow money from the Federal Reserve, Bank of Canada, Bank of Switzerland, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and this is what's keeping the system going. The central banks, are creating credit to be given to these financial institutions. And they have all become very, very much more conservative in their lending because of the deplorable decisions they previously made. And that's hurting the system, because if they don't loosen up and allow more borrowing to go on, especially to business, this whole thing is going to shrink. And those assets are going to go further down in value that they're already holding, and it's going to throw us into a depression. And if the U.S. goes into depression, I think the rest of the world has a pretty good chance of following.
And also, the next question I have for you, what would happen if the Federal Reserve down in the United States and also other nations, if they deprivatized money and then basically put it back in control of the people where it should be?
Well, that would have to involve an act of Congress, and they would have to say that the privately owned Federal Reserve System is now defunct, and all of their responsibilities have been turned over to the U.S. Treasury. I think that could eventually happen. We would need the kind of strong president to do such a thing who really understood the problem, like John F. Kennedy did. That's one of the reasons he's not with us anymore. And so we would need a strong president, and we would need a Congress with guts, and both do not exist. The two candidates for the new presidency don't have that kind of gumption, and they're controlled by people from behind the scenes, just like so many others have been in their position. Congress is truly bought and paid for or compromised. Their approval rating in the United States, if you can believe this, is 7%. I mean, how bad does it get? And I've been telling our subscribers, please, with minor exception, please vote them all out of office. I mean, if we get a whole new crop, it can't be as bad as what we've got.
And quickly, so we can basically, the listening audience can also go to your you have a website where you have your subscriptions for your newsletter where people can basically purchase them there. What is your website address?
The International Forecast is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues. We publish by email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, runs around 30 pages each time. And we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month to those who are not on the Internet. The address on the Internet for us, our site, is theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. If you'd like to email us a question, we answer everybody. That address is international_forecaster@yahoo.com. international_forecaster@yahoo.com.
And in 1988, the federal Canadian Conservative government, under Brian Mulroney, who had the lowest approval rating ever of a Canadian leader, passed the Bank Acts here in Canada, which no longer required the charter banks to keep a tiny percentage of their deposit in the Bank of Canada. What would be some of the biggest benefits, in your opinion, if the Act were repealed and these charter banks were forced to keep a reserve in the Bank of Canada?
Well, at one time it used to be 17%, and then now they've got it whittled down to a minimum of 8%, which is a far cry from what you've got. And I think that would, under a fractional banking system, it certainly would bring more stability, because it would mean that it would limit their borrowing to some extent, and it would also make them be quite sure about the loans that they were making. In other words, they wouldn't be making any borderline loans. And so I think the rescission of that law would be a very, very good thing for the solvency of the Canadian banking system. And I guess when Mr. Mulroney was in office, he wasn't what everybody would have liked to have been him to be. And I see that there was a final settlement on that Airbus deal, and also I was surprised to see that he was on the board of Barrick Gold.
Yeah, I did an interview with a gentleman that ran into Barrick Gold. This gentleman owned Minnepaska Llama, and Barrick Gold tried to claim ownership of Minnepaska Llama. This gentleman in question then received a letter from the top law firm from Chile saying he's a sole owner. So it's just amazing what Barrick Gold will do to people if they get in their way. Barrick Gold borrowed $500 million from Deutsche Bank to help finance this Minnepaska Llama, then used Minnepaska Llama also to borrow other loans to help finance their other mining operations throughout South America. Do you know any more about that situation?
Only that I don't think they'll ever get approval.
And also, in your humble opinion, who do you think some of the major players are in causing this financial crisis to begin with, and who benefits the most from what happens?
Well, first of all, I'd have to go back 1,000 years, because that's how long this has been going on. There are people behind the scenes who are running this thing, families, connections. They just do it over and over and over again. And you can look at groups like in America, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, which meets in a different place each year since 1954. And there's a whole myriad of sub-organizations that these people belong to, and they cooperate with one another, sometimes very closely. And that's why you see this musical chairs game that's played between the United States government and Wall Street. It's incestuous. And these are the people who run things behind the scenes. They do what they want to do. There's two sets of laws, one for them and one for everybody else. And Barrick's a good example. You know, Canadians should know the history of Peter Munk, and he should have been put in jail. And the only reason he avoided, he went to American Samoa, where there was no extradition. But anyway, these people are there. They're not going to go away. They are the ones who execute these operations, such as the dot-com craze in the U.S. stock market in the late 1990s, and then the terrible, terrible real estate fiasco that America is going through in some other countries as well. We've got Spain, England, Denmark, Ireland, and we also have New Zealand and Australia on the edge as well. And they were using all the same precepts. Anybody that could make it up to the line and put their mark on a piece of paper got a mortgage loan. So that's not the way to do business, and they know that. And so the question comes to the surface. Do they really want to destroy the system so they can profit from it? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, back in the 30s, there was a called the business coup, with attempted overthrow of the Roosevelt, and they tried to pull in a retired general, Butler, and he was the one that turned them in. And amazing that this tied in with some very powerful business people in the United States. And what happened was, when Congress started to do investigation on it, it was quickly pushed under the rug and hush-hush, because if they would have continued doing it, they would have started exposing some major, major families within the United States. And it's almost like, if you take a look at the Bush's history, George Bush's grandfather was involved with a bank that was majorly involved with Adolf Hitler, being the Nazis. And what you're seeing is, you're seeing a history of the Bush family being a very dark history. Yet what happens is, that didn't come out until a couple years ago. And if it would have come out right when Bush was running for president, I'm wondering what the American people would think, knowing that they were electing someone who was family was you know, had family ties directly tied in with the far, far right.
Well, first of all, there were many, many people who I'm in connection with who knew all that before then. Even if you tell the public, 50% of them won't believe you. If you tell the public that there are forces behind government that control everything, they won't believe you. And then when you start naming names and telling the people, oh, he wouldn't do such a thing, he's a nice man, or he's so successful, he's this and that, and so on. You know, just as an example, even though he's a politician, Brian Mulroney fit into that category. Of course, he was really just a hanger-on, and you know, a go-to do-it guy, and he still is, as a matter of fact. But these forces exist, and yes, the as it turns out, from my historical viewpoint, was that the things that happened in Europe during the 1930s were a dry run for what we're seeing today. And the powers behind government, the corporatists, they now know what not to do to institute fascism. And the United States government is a corporatist fascist government, just like Benito Mussolini's Italy and Adolf Hitler's Germany. And we've got the Patriot Acts in the United States, and they will be used just like the acts that we used starting in 1933 to make people do what the National Socialist Party wanted them to do. And it really has nothing to do with parties. It has everything to do with the powers behind what is going on. And they know no political party, because they try to own them both. And at present, at least in the United States, they do.
And also, a question about the stock market at this time, if I may. The precious metals and the oil and other commodities, how are these being manipulated at this time, and how much further do you think that they can go up or down?
Well, first of all markets are being manipulated by the United States government. And that's legal for them to do that on an executive act that was promulgated by Ronald Reagan in August of 1988. And what it said was, in essence, when markets are in turmoil, a government can step in to keep them from collapsing. Well, of course, like almost everything else, it's been distorted, and the United States government and the people who control that government from behind the scenes are in every market in the world every day rigging it. So all markets are affected. I mean, just the other day, we had some of the most dreadful news imaginable, and the stock market went up 375 points. All I can say is, give me a break. Anybody who can't see through that needs to go back to school. Now, as far as what the concern recently about the drop in commodity and precious metals prices, and that is, except for the precious metals, commodities were overpriced. There's no question. And the energy complex was given a little impetus because it was subject to a possible invasion of Iran or someplace else, perhaps. And so the excesses in speculation that went on there are at least feasible. But in the other parts of the market, I think the underlying factor in the beans and grains was ethanol and the production thereof, which is insanity, which I won't go into, but it doesn't work very well, and it's costing the taxpayer a lot of money, and a lot of people are starving to death because of the cost of these products. Now, we've seen a correction of approximately 20-25% in most of those areas, and that includes as well the precious metals, which really didn't go up. And so it's kind of like the baby being thrown out with the bathwater. But I think that the commodity correction, excuse me, presently is just about over. Might take another week or two. And I think we're seeing the bottoms again on gold, silver, platinum, palladium. And it'll take a few weeks, maybe a month and a half, and they'll be right back on their way again. And there's some wonderful buys out there, not only in the commodities, but in Canadian mining shares, especially in the better quality issues. So I advise you, if you like that sort of thing, you better take a hard look, because it's a good time to buy.
And also, throughout Canada and the U.S., there have been repeated examples of how much damage that NAFTA, free trade, and other international trade agreements have done to too many people. Can these agreements be taken down, and will the affected areas in North America be able to recover?
Well, first of all, Canada's done fairly well under the circumstances. Industry in the United States has been hammered, and farming in Mexico is, except for certain sections of their country, it's been decimated. They had a lot of small farmers, and they were all driven out of business by subsidized products. And if you notice that the Doha round of talks by the World Trade Organization just fell apart again, it's because the, quote, third world is unwilling to destroy their agriculture of their countries just to make people in Europe and the United States happy. And most of that subsidized and owned by very wealthy corporations and individuals. And so I think in time NAFTA will end up being rescinded. I think the North American Union, which has been trying to be promulgated by the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States, I think it's all but dead for the time being, although they aren't going to lay down. They're going to keep on laying their groundwork. But exposures, you know, really killed it. And thank goodness for that, because I don't think Canadians want to become Americans, and I don't think Americans want to become Mexicans. I mean, we all have three distinct cultures, even though the cultures of Canada and the United States are somewhat similar. The thought processes are much different, and of course, Mexico is a much, much different culture than both Canada and the United States. So I think the world of amalgamation has got stopped at the pass, at least for the time being. And I see a reversal coming, particularly because of the rejection of the Doha Round, a rejection coming of free trade and globalization, which is outsourcing and offshoring, which has been absolute murder in the United States. We've lost over 5 million jobs in the last 8 years, and they were good-paying jobs. And it's served to eventually will put Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler into bankruptcy. And I think it's tragic. It's happening in Canada, of course, in Ontario and Quebec, because they did a lot of those kind of things. And it's very, very hard to compete when you've got a transnational corporation that's operating in a country that has slave labor. And it's got to be stopped. And the only way to stop that is for each country to put up their own trade barriers. And I'm probably one of the few newsletter writers in the world who advocates that. In fact, I haven't heard anybody else. But it's the only way to stop it. Because before you know it, you're going to have a total service economy in Canada, just like the United States is headed for.
Yeah, and being someone who's had a chance to experience both cultures in the United States and Canada, I agree with you, Bob. It is drastically different. Not only is some of our spelling different, also that some of our thought patterns, as you were saying, up here when we say conservative, we mean conservative government, conservative party. Down in the United States, when you say conservative, you mean conservative person. So it's drastically different how we'll look at different words and also different situations, as you were also saying. And also, at this time, the housing in the United States, they're having problems with the subprime mortgage and all that. Do you see the situation getting much grimmer in regards to people losing their houses, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac reporting record losses?
Yes. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been bankrupts for 4 years. And all this falderon you're listening to is nothing but lies, just like U.S. government statistics and the statistics of most governments. And we just experienced the subprime problem, which should be over with by the end of next June. And that is being joined by the ALT-A called ALTA loans, which are just another step higher. But more money's involved in the value of the original home's value. And that's going to go on for another year or two as well. Now, what's coming down the road here is people who had good credit, who wanted a minimum payment on their home so they could really capitalize in the appreciation and didn't pay anything against principal. So they had an interest-only loan, and sometimes not even that. Those are coming due to people who are speculating. And the numbers on those loans are twice what the other two were. And right now, in the 2006 loans that were made in what they're called option arm or pick and pay loans, their rate of default more than 90 days behind or foreclosure is already 48%. And incidentally, in the subprimes, I had projected 50%, and now even Fannie and Freddie are talking about 65% failure rate. I mean, the whole thing, to put it very succinctly, is a dog's breakfast. It's not going to go away soon. American house prices got another 20% to go down, and that's nationwide. I would think that most areas will go down in the former 30 hot areas. We'll take, you know, L.A., San Francisco, Nevada, Arizona, etc. They'll go down anywhere between 40 and 60%. So we got a long way to go. And then when the 5 years are up, we're looking at 2012. And then how many years are we looking at bumping along the bottom? It can be 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So in the United States and the countries I mentioned earlier, they're going to continue to have problems for a long time, which is going to affect the entire world economy.
And also, recently in the United States, they had that housing bill passed where they kicked some money, about $300 billion, over to help out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The question I have for you is, did that make any difference at all, or is it nothing more than just propping up the corruption until it basically the poles underneath just collapse and it all just falls down?
You're right. It is a halfway measure. The number was $800 billion, and it just so happens that foreigners are holding $800 billion worth of bonds in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The entire figure, I think, is $3.7 trillion, or $2.7 trillion. Anyway, it's up there. And the loans that are being insured by Fannie and Freddie are securitized. Around $5.2 trillion. My guess is more than $2 trillion will be lost, maybe as much as $3 trillion. And I know these are impossible figures, but they're true. And that $800 billion is kind of a down payment, and it's pointed toward those foreign buyers of the security so that they won't dump the dollar. And they won't dump their paper, which is the bonds in Fannie and Freddie. So what they're being told is, hey, we're guaranteeing you that we're going to back these bonds no matter what, even if the American public has to pay for it. And the American public will pay the bill for the soon-to-be-nationalized Fannie and Freddie, and that bill will be over $2 trillion just in that sector alone.
And also, I've heard reports that down in South America that they're going to be coming out with a new their own currency after the U.S. dollar collapses. How will this affect the marketplace, and how long before the U.S. dollar hits rock bottom and has a possibility of no longer existing?
Well, I think if anything, they would devalue the dollar. I don't think they'll come out with a new unit. Secondly, having a unit in South America would be somewhat difficult. Argentina, again, is looking at 25% inflation. They still have $20 billion to clean up, and the disputed loans for the 2001 collapse of their financial system, essentially. And now they're on the hook for about another $30 billion. Argentina, which is one of the larger countries in South America, has serious problems. Chile is getting along okay. Uruguay is okay. Brazil is doing very well, and they probably have run their finance system, which you could have never handicapped this. I mean, the last thing you would have thought of that they would have done the right thing, which they did, is that they were very solvent. So Brazil's done fine. But the rest of the countries have been taken over by leftists who are intent to a great extent in nationalizing or socializing or whatever you want to call it, industries. And Venezuela is a good example, and is in some of the other countries as well, Bolivia, Ecuador, in particular. When you have this sort of thing going on, you can't get enough cohesion to create a monetary unit. I think it's some years away, just like the Muslim nations wanted to create a gold currency and for trade at the beginning. And that hasn't got much of anywhere either after 10 years. So I don't see that currency coming to the fore. There's too many problems down there still.
And I just have two more questions for you. One of them is what type of prices could ordinary people in Canada and even the U.S. face if a few elitists were successful at their attempts at privatization of our water rights?
Well, number one, if you're a Canadian, you never, ever, ever want that sort of thing to happen. And you never want a treaty between the United States and Canada allowing the United States to draw on Canadian water. And it's one of the reasons that they wanted to have the North American Union so so they could get cheap water from Canada. It's a natural resource, and it's extremely important to Canada. And I think if the United States wants water, they got to pay a very, very stiff price for it.
And also, the last question I have for you is, what prices do you see the oil market being in 6 months' time and even a year?
The worst possible price can be $80 a barrel, but I don't think it'll get there. And I do not think there'll be war with Iran. And that's a whole different subject that we can't cover in our time span today. But, and I've said that for the last 2 years. The natural level of correction from its high would be somewhere between 1 and 120 a barrel, and U.S. funds, more nearly 1 to 110. I think it'll be there very shortly, in the next week or two, wherever it's going. And it's already in the 117 area. And I think it'll stay there for at least another year. And the world economy will continue to diminish in trade and commerce. And I think as time goes on, less oil will be used. And in time, once deflation starts, we're in hyperinflation now in the United States and a number of other countries. And once the hyperinflation ends, which is probably 2 or 3 years down the line, deflation will begin, and that will take gold down, oil down considerably further. What's going to really profit by all of this is investments in gold and silver. So any gold and silver-related asset, I believe, is a good place to be.
And also, lastly, could you leave some, again, could you leave your contact information? Because just in case we didn't fully expand upon some issues that we covered here today because of the time restriction. So that way people can email you and ask you further upon some stuff we covered?
That would be easy. Again, you can get a free introductory copy by going to the site. And the address for that is the International Forecaster.com, the International Forecaster.com, email address International_Forecaster@Yahoo.com, International_Forecaster@Yahoo.com, and if you want to call 800, you can call 800-375-4188, 800-375-4188. And you can leave your phone number, and we'll call you if you like. And you can email your phone number if you want, or just ask a question, and we'll email you back. And in all of that, you'll receive a free copy.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Bob. And just keep up the good work, because you are truly informing all of us, and you're a very brave individual. And that was Bob Chapman. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. You've been listening to the Money Brown Bagger. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. This is the Monday Brown Bagger. It is the 18th of August, 2008. Our next guest is Dr. Robert M. Bowman, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force retired, who is the President of the Institute for Space and Security Studies, Executive Vice President of the Millennium 3 Corporation, and retired presiding Archbishop of the United Catholic Church. Dr. Bowman is also recipient of countless other awards, medals, and certificates, and he will be here in Vancouver, B.C. on a speaking tour at the Maritime Labor Centers on Friday, August 22nd. The doors open at 7:30. It starts at 7:30. The doors open at 7, and tickets are $10 at the door. For more information, please visit www.vancouver911truth.org. Hello, Dr. Bowman.
Hello.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. In 2000, you ran as a U.S. president candidate for U.S. presidency. What are your thoughts on how McCain has made jokes about bombing Iran and also called for a 100-year war, and now Obama has come out and said, when he was asked about if that's a question by CNN, if any sort of apology is due over the U.S. foreign policies over the last 7.5 years, Obama's response was, no, I don't believe in the U.S. apologizing. We made some mistakes. As I said, I think the war in Iraq was a mistake. We didn't keep our eye on the ball in Afghanistan. But you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I'm much more interested in looking forward rather than looking backwards. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first on McCain, my guess is that he's just mentally unbalanced, partly because of his experiences in prison. But, you know, he sort of scares me. Obama's another thing. I'm very disappointed at such talk coming from Obama. Obviously, he's listening to his mentor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and other advisors that have been around a lot longer, but who don't have his sensitivities. I would like to expect better things from him.
And also, ever since Bush Sr. came to power until now, in that timeline, we have seen Gulf War I, Gulf War illness, countless homeless veterans, corporate corruption on levels never thought possible before, which should be causing Roosevelt to roll over in his grave, dumbing down of American children and lower educational standards, Gulf War II, and countless other unethical actions, which has financially and physically almost bankrupted the United States. As the U.S. Constitution appears to be hanging only by a thread, with all of this in mind, how can people, in your humble opinion, regain the power in the United States and throughout the whole world?
Well, that's what my 45-minute talk is about. it's not going to be easy. First of all, we have to wake up the vast majority of the American people who do not yet understand that these things have been happening. They don't realize how endangered our Constitution is, how many of our rights we have already lost, how corporate domination of our foreign policy, our international trade, and our military decisions through our government have devastated this country, gotten us into unnecessary and illegal wars of aggression, and how corporate domination of our government, in addition, has forced down their wages year after year after year. Real wages in the United States are now a third of what they were in the 1950s. And this in spite of soaring productivity. You know, with the productivity advances that we have made in this country, with the amount of wealth created by workers each hour, ordinary workers ought to be able to support their family. One wage earner per family, not two. One job, paying a living wage, working 2 days a week. Everybody ought to have five-day weekends, and you ought to be able to easily support your family. That's the way it should be because of the productivity advances we have. Instead of that, where we used to support a family with one job working 40 hours a week, today it takes three jobs.
And I also like to remind our listening audience that Dr. Bowman will be in Victoria on August 23rd at St. Anne's Academy, and that's doors will be opening at 2 o'clock is what I've been told. And so the next question I have for you, presently off the top of your head, what type of budget do you think has been sent over to a black ops operation in the United States in regards to spying on the people and also throughout the world? Secondly, could the horrific day of 9/11, where so many innocent people were tragically killed, have been a black ops operation used by allegedly Middle Eastern men as puppets to carry out these horrendous attacks, which in turn permitted the Nazism and the old Soviet Union Stalinism control to once again have a chance to grip United States and the world in their grasp?
Well, I don't know what the budget is these days. We used to have a black budget, which was a significant portion of the overall defense budget. But now with the budgets for the intelligence agencies and much of their real income is hidden. I mean, the CIA is our largest drug dealer by far. They bring far more cocaine and heroin into the United States than all of the other petty drug dealers combined. So, I mean, who knows how much the CIA and the other intelligence agencies are spending on black operations and dirty tricks. They have been responsible for instability, insurrection, tyranny, torture, terrorism, murder, and war around the world in our name and with our money. And it's got to stop.
And also, on the day of September 11, 2001, Vice President Channing had taken over command of NORAD from reports which were stating that there was some sort of war games exercise going on that day. How many times before has any vice president resumed control over NORAD, and what are your thoughts on this issue?
Well, I don't think it ever happened before, and the exercises of that day were absolutely unprecedented. And, I mean, those are, you know, some of the reasons for thinking that what happened on 9/11 was certainly not a coincidence. And it could not have been pulled off by 19 Arabs with box cutters and an old man on a dialysis machine in a cave.
And also, you spent some time being in charge of Star Wars. What are the dangers of Star Wars combined with RFF chips, LoJack, OnStar, cell phone tracking devices, and numerous other forms of government and corporate monitoring software and other devices?
Well, that's a bunch of questions, but Star Wars is something that I have been speaking out against since 1981. I directed all the Star Wars programs in the 1970s under Ford and Carter, and when Reagan was elected, into power with him came the crazies, what we in the military used to call the lunatic fringe, people like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, same people who sort of went into the woodwork for a while, and then when W was elected, they came right back into the government and seized control again. And these people have been pushing Star Wars weapons in space in order to have absolute military superiority and to rule the world. They also want all of the privacy invading things that you mentioned, the chips and so forth, give them the power to control the populace. And you have to understand that when the Department of Homeland Security was formed, I mean, I was against it from the get-go and speaking out gave a speech in Duluth, in which I had a make-believe conversation with Bush and talking about trying to understand why he wanted the Department of Homeland Security and all of that. And it's obvious the job of the Department of Defense and the CIA is to protect puppet dictators around the world from their people.
And also,
and create terrorists to scare the bejeebers out of the American people. And the Department of Homeland Security is to protect Bush from us. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security is not out there to protect us from terrorists. It's to protect the wealthy elite from us, the people of the United States and Canada.
And also, there's the next question is it in 2007, there was an act passed called Protect America Act, which was passed by U.S. Congress that legalized warrantless surveillance. And in cases of a few major communications corporations, were given direct pardons for any past illegal wiretapping that they had been involved with the U.S. government in the name of alleged war on terrorism. What is your thoughts on that act of many people call act of treason?
It is. Well, for one thing, I think all such acts are unconstitutional. The U.S. Congress does not have the authority to give away our constitutional rights. In order to rob us of our rights, as given to us in the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, Congress has to pass amendments to the Constitution and get them ratified by the states. Now, that hasn't happened, isn't going to happen. And so anything that they pass that tries to take away those rights is valid because it's unconstitutional.
And I'd also like to point out, Dr. Bowman, that we're having some problems with your communication with you, that sometimes it's almost like someone's trying to jam right now. So, you know, that just shows you how important you are to tell us the truth, because if someone's taking their time to do this, that means that you have something really extremely important to say. And I remind the listening audience again that Dr. Bowman will be here in person here in Vancouver to listen to, so that way no one can jam him. He'll be at the Maritime Center here in Vancouver, and speaking at this Friday, the 22nd. It starts at 7:30. The doors open at 7 p.m. And for more information, go to vancouver911truth.org. And you'll be in Victoria at St. Anne's Academy Saturday, the 23rd at 2 o'clock. The next question I have for you is, now that the American military is allowed to go into cities when there's a declared state of emergency or national disaster or whatever, and they're allowed to act like police, doesn't that sound like it's almost like America is turning the clock back and going back to prior to the U.S. Constitution even existing, when the British used to occupy United States prior to United States becoming a country?
Well, sure. That, again, is another one of those unconstitutional acts that violates the Constitution and, therefore, is invalid. But, you know, if President George W. Bush tries to impose martial law and cancel the election, as many people fear, or cancel the results of the election, I don't think he's going to get away from it, because there are a lot of good people in the military in the United States. There are a lot of loyal, dedicated generals and admirals in the Pentagon who take seriously their oath of office, which is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And that, by the way, includes a renegade president and vice president. So it's my contention that if Bush declares martial law and is to get the military to round up us dissidents, I think the military are going to surround us and point their guns outward to protect us from Blackwater.
And also, the next question I have for you is, here in Canada, some war resistors have come up from United States. And the Parliament, Canadian Parliament, just voted to let them stay. However, that's not an acting law, because it was only sort of just basically can't be enacted because the Conservatives won't enact it. So now they've deported one of the war resistors that, you know, back during Trudeau's day, they would allow war resistors to stay. What is your thoughts on how the Canadian government, by their action, the federal Conservative government is now in power, is indirectly, by sending war resistor back, is backing George Bush on his illegal war and invasion of Iraq?
Well, Yeah, that's not the only way that he's been backing Bush in the war in Iraq. Many people in Canada don't realize that their government is heavily involved in Iraq, that Canadian warships and soldiers were involved in the original shock and awe, that the Canadian military has provided logistics support, that there are 3,000 Canadian military in Iraq as volunteers, that a Canadian general was second in command of all the forces in Iraq for early in the war, and that by taking a major role in Afghanistan, Canadian forces have freed up American troops for service in Iraq. And, of course, Canadian troops have paid dearly for their activities in Afghanistan. It seems every couple of weeks I read about another Canadian soldier being killed. So there's heavy involvement there already. But, you know, I don't want these things to happen to Canada. I love Canada, and I'm very grateful to Canada for giving sanctuary to our war resistors, you know, going back certainly to the Vietnam War, and for providing them with hospitality. And I think to turn that around and start deporting folks to the back to the U.S. Because they are conscientious objectors to illegal wars of aggression, I think it's a shame, and I hate to see it. And one of the titles of my talk that I will be giving in Canada is, Can Canada Escape Domination by U.S. Corporate Powers and Multinational Corporations? The multinational corporations, which are now dominating the U.S. government, have their sights firmly set on Canada as well. And if they are successful in implementing this Strategic and Security and Prosperity Partnership, or North American Union, it is totally anti-democratic. It is set up strictly for corporate profits, and it will mean that the people in Canada will lose their civil rights just as we have lost ours in the United States. And I am fighting that North American Union, which will destroy our sovereignty, your sovereignty, will destroy our unique cultures, and will deny us the rights that we now take for granted.
Yeah, and also one of the corporations, if I may point to, is Lockheed Martin, who was involved with the Canadian census in 2006. What Lockheed Martin did was they're the largest producer of weapons in the world. They designed the software to help process the information gathered from the census. As I was saying when I interviewed Sandra Finley, you know, there's possibility that it could be some sort of backdoor to access to the program, which could give the war machine access to the information. So that's another way how Canada is now in danger with NAFTA. We've allowed our sort of one of our fronts to open up, and it's like we're becoming extremely weak to defend ourselves. We only have about 2 minutes left. If you could quickly leave us with some last inspirational words, and we're going to extremely looking forward to hearing you on this Friday.
Well, first, folks, you can check out my website, thepatriots.us, and there's a lot of information there. I spoke in Toronto a few weeks ago. I'm looking forward to being in Vancouver and Victoria. And I took one of my granddaughters into Canada once, and she was scared. She says, "Will we be able to get back? They're not free up there. My teacher told us that the United States is the only free country in the world." And I told her, "Look, you're going to be okay. They're freer in Canada than we are in the United States. My job is to keep it that way and for us to gradually regain our freedoms here. And I look forward to being with you.
Well, thank you very much, sir, Dr. Bowman, that you are truly a very brave individual, and you should be used as an example for other people to gather inspiration from. And I'd just like to thank you again for coming on. Thank you very much for coming on, Dr. Bowman.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. You're listening to Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus-Argue. This is August 18th.